You're listening to the FQXI podcast. Our first item is both closer to home and about as distant from Earth as it can possibly be, since it encompasses the effects of interacting parallel universes on lab experiments that physicists carry out every day. This is a new theory proposed by physicist Howard Wiseman of Griffith University in Brisbane, Australia, and colleagues. They have shown that many of the weird and wonderful quantum effects that we measure, the uncertainty and the general fuzziness of the quantum realm, could arise from the repulsive forces between many interacting classical universes.
On the podcast, we've often talked about the many worlds interpretation of quantum physics set up by Hugh Everett, in which quantum processes create multiple parallel universes. This is a totally different idea, however. In Wiseman's setup, the contents of each parallel world are governed only by classical physics, Newton's laws of motion, and other straightforward, non-spooky laws.
Earlier, I spoke with Wiseman, who explained to me how nearby classical universes could interact in such a way that they would manifest various quantum phenomena in our experiments.
So I guess quantum physics is notoriously problematic. It's, of course, a very successful theory. The point is that it's hard to relate the maths to the everyday world. What we were really motivated by was to come up with a sort of realistic way of describing quantum phenomena. So our theory we call the many interacting worlds approach to quantum mechanics. So the worlds are just like you learn about in high school, with particles moving, with forces on those particles. But that would just be classical. We know the world's not classical. So what we postulate is that there are a huge number of parallel worlds. Some of them are going to be completely different from our worlds. Others of them are going to be almost the same, you know, down to just a microscopically different position of a single particle, say. And what we're postulating is an interaction between those parallel worlds, which only takes place when they are extremely similar. And what we've shown, or at least plausibly argued, is that you can come up with an interaction which will give you all of quantum mechanics out of this interaction between essentially classical worlds.
There's one quite famous interpretation of quantum mechanics that a lot of our listeners will be familiar with. I'm just going to bring it up so that we can differentiate your idea from that one, because some of the words might, you know, lead people to think you're talking about the same idea.
I know what you're going to say. Yeah, go on.
Yes. You know what I'm going to say, because I'm going to ask you about Hugh Everett's interpretation of quantum mechanics, the many worlds interpretation. You know, it appears in a lot of science fiction stories. It's about parallel worlds. And, you know, the way we kind of think about it is if there's a quantum experiment and it could have two different possible outcomes, then in this interpretation, you know, both of these outcomes are realized, but they're realized in two separate parallel universes that kind of pop into existence. Now, that's not your theory. So if you could tell us your theory and just explain to us what's different between your theory and this one.
Now, the many worlds interpretation is describing worlds which are constantly splitting whenever quantum measurements are done, etc. Okay. And it's all completely based in the quantum mechanical formalism. What we're doing is starting from a completely fresh perspective, if you like. Well, of course, there are precedents to our work. Bill Poirier and Peter Holland considered replacing a wave function by an ensemble of trajectories of particles and worlds. And I'd also like to mention Charles Siebens, the young philosopher who independently of us came up with essentially the same idea, but he took it in a more philosophical direction. But compared to the many worlds interpretation, what we're doing is completely different. We're actually looking at classical worlds. So whereas in the many worlds interpretation, you have branching events happening when you have something which is like a quantum measurement, in our interpretation, all the worlds have been there from the beginning. So worlds don't branch, they're just there, and they interact.
Where do these classical worlds come from? You say that they've been around, you know, from the beginning, but why are there these multiple classical worlds?
So why are they?
Maybe I could ask you why there's any world at all. I suppose it's a deep philosophical question. But
yeah, this is our first paper on the topic. We aren't at the stage, therefore, of addressing questions like, you know, the origins of the universe, or where these worlds come from, or why they had the initial conditions that they did. So there's obviously a huge amount of questions that you could ask and still go on. But all we can say is that if you postulate the existence of these worlds, then you can reproduce quantum phenomena without having any of the hard-to-understand weirdness of quantum mechanics.
And so in your paper, you kind of run through a checklist of some of these weird quantum phenomena that you can begin to try to understand using this formulation. So perhaps we could sort of run through them now. So, you know, to begin with, I guess, you know, one of the things about quantum experiments, you know, it's quite famous, this idea that you can't predict the outcome of an experiment. You can only predict the probability of getting a certain outcome. So, you know, how would we think about that in this picture of yours?
So in our interpretation, we postulate this very large but finite number of worlds. And initially you just say, well, I don't know which world I'm in. So I'm equally likely to be in any one of those worlds. Now, of course, when you open your eyes and look around you, you can see all sorts of things about the actual world, and that will narrow down the possible worlds you'll be in, okay? So the essential idea is that probability is just about your lack of knowledge about which of these interacting many parallel worlds you are actually in. Now, you say, well, okay, but if I do an experiment, I could find out something about that microscopic details, and that's true, and then what will happen at that point, it's like if you can sort of imagine a wide freeway going along with cars going in parallel, driving down the freeway. And the drivers in those cars had their eyes closed. So it's just running on some autopilot GPS type thing, say. So the drivers in those cars don't know which of those parallel worlds they're on. But then if it comes to a split in the freeway, say there's an off-ramp and the two left lanes have to go off or something like that, then, you know, if you were in one of those cars in the left lane, then you'll find yourself going off the freeway and ending up somewhere else, and then your GPS will tell you, hey, you're no longer on the freeway. So that's how we can explain probability in our theory. But there's nothing actually probabilistic about the way the worlds evolve. It's just your lack of knowledge about which world you're on to begin with.
Okay, so let's talk about quantum tunneling. So this case where quantum particles can kind of surmount barriers that they shouldn't classically have enough energy to kind of climb over. Sort of like, you know, me popping out on the other side of a wall suddenly, even though there shouldn't be any way that I was able to do that. So how does, you know, thinking about interacting classical worlds help explain tunneling?
Yeah, that's a really nice example which my co-author Michael Hall, who's also at Griffith University, came up with. So in our theory, when we say a quantum particle is going towards a barrier, that really means that, you know, we have all these parallel worlds. So there are, you know, in each of those worlds, there is a particle going towards that barrier. But, you know, in each world, the particle has a slightly different position. Now, because of the interaction between the worlds, which we describe by this very particular inter-world force field, it's a repulsive type interaction, okay? So that's very important. It prevents worlds from ever becoming the same because if they get closer, then this interaction actually pushes them apart. This repulsion means that a world which is closer to the barrier gets pushed towards it, and one which is further away from the barrier gets pushed slightly backwards in the other direction, so that the one in a world where it's closest to the barrier is actually going faster than the average, and it can have enough energy to get through the barrier.
You know, would somebody doing the equivalent experiment in the other world, which is interacting with this one, see the same thing? Is there some kind of trade-off in these energies? Do we see extra energy and they see less energy, or do they see the same thing?
If I am the me that's in the world where, you know, the particle does have enough energy to get over the barrier, then I'll see as a result of my experiment that the particle gets over the barrier. It'll go clicking the detector on the other side of the barrier. But if I'm one of the me's which is in one of those parallel worlds where the particle doesn't have enough energy to get over the barrier, then I'll see that it gets reflected and that there'll be a click in a different detector somewhere else. So energy is conserved overall, but there can be more energy in one universe and less energy in another universe.
Oh, I see. Okay, so energy is conserved overall, all of these kind of classical worlds, but there can be a bit of a sort of interplay between the two. That's where this interaction is coming from, this kind of swapping about of energy.
Exactly. So there's an interaction which allows the exchange of energy between universes.
You said something very interesting there when you started to talk about this kind of repulsive force between the interacting worlds and how, I guess, you don't want them to kind of collapse into being the same world. They have to kind of maintain some kind of separate identity.
Yeah, so that's what's novel about our theory, is you actually wrote down a potential energy, which gives you a force, which depends on the distances between nearby worlds. So we were guided by previous existing equations to write down that potential energy term, because obviously we know that quantum effects are real, so we want to be able to reproduce them. So we came up with a toy model where we said, okay, what's the simplest potential energy term we can write down, or the simplest force we can write down, which is, you know, related to the distance between the worlds, and what we know we sort of need to get quantum mechanical predictions in the end.
And when you talk about distance between the worlds, yeah. I guess we're not talking about kind of literal space as we know it, that, you know, one world is 300 meters away from this world or something, but you're talking about some kind of measure of the similarity between the worlds. What does distance mean when you use it?
If you think of all the particles in the universe, so all the particles in one world, all the particles in another world, so make a list of all of them and their positions, and then look at the difference between the positions for every single particle. And so what's unusual about our interaction, you know, which is why it makes sense to talk about these as parallel worlds that almost don't interact, is that there is no interaction between them unless every single particle in one universe is very close to every single particle in the other universe.
Can this explain why it is that we only see quantum phenomena on very small scales rather than me popping through a wall or existing in two places at the same time or something like that? Why don't we see quantum effects on a much larger scale?
If I just give an intuitive answer to your question, if you imagine trying to do an experiment where you want to see whether you can, you know, tunnel through a wall or not, in a sense, it's a whole lot of particles which have to be exactly the same in every world in order to see an effect like that. And that's just an experiment which is much, much harder to do.
Let me ask you about some of these other, you know, quantum oddities that you've gone through in your paper. So another one is zero point energy. So it's this idea that, you know, we're never going to, I guess, you know, get a quantum particle to sit completely still. It's always going to have some kind of energy to it. So can you explain that?
So in our interpretation, so that particle, if it's microscopic, you'll see this effect. You know, there are many parallel worlds describing this one particle. And because of the repulsion between those worlds, they won't all have the same position. Okay, some will get pushed further away than others. There's some energy there. And if you work out the average amount of energy that comes out per world as a consequence of the repulsion that makes this happen, it's exactly what you calculate in standard quantum mechanics as the zero-point energy. Well, I should say, when I say it's exactly that in the limit that the number of worlds becomes very large. So basically, you can interpolate between classical physics, where the number of worlds, n, is equal to 1, in which case, at rest, the particle has zero energy, to the quantum mechanical result as the number of worlds n goes to infinity, and then you end up with exactly the amount of energy per world is exactly what you get from standard quantum mechanics.
Okay.
Yeah, and when I talk about particles, it turns out that this description describes quantum fields, and so people probably have heard of the zero-point energy in relation to, you know, quantum fields which fill all of space. Sometimes it's called the vacuum energy. So, you know, it explains that energy for fields as well as particles.
So another famous feature of quantum mechanics is that, you know, there's this kind of duality between waves and particles. So, you know, light can exhibit behavior like a particle, it can act like a wave. And one experiment that really highlights this is the double slit experiment. So I think this is something that you've looked into in quite a lot of detail. So Can you explain to us what the double slit experiment is and then how you can explain that using this model of interacting classical worlds?
So the double slit experiment is where you have a quantum particle going towards a screen, and there are two slits in that screen. And, well, ordinarily, if it's a particle, if we were just talking classical physics, if you see it on the other side of the screen, then it must have gone through, you know, either the top slit or the bottom slit. In quantum mechanics, we can do an experiment, so this is a famous interference experiment using this double slit, where, let's say, we block off the bottom slit and just look at what happens with the particle in the top slit. Well, then what you see a long way away from the screen, if the particle gets through, is the particle turns up at an apparently random place on the screen. And it's not a very interesting pattern, it's just this broad blob. But if I have both slits open at the same time and send my quantum particle towards that, then I get what's called an interference pattern. And so basically you get the stripes appearing, which are called interference fringes. Okay, so how do you explain this? If you think of the particle as going through either the top slit or the bottom slit, so how does the particle know when it goes through the bottom slit whether the top slit is open or not? Okay, because if the top slit is open, then it should go, you know, it's somewhere which gives you this interesting pattern, whereas if the top slit is closed, then you just get this boring pattern. So in standard quantum mechanics, the answer is actually there is no particle, or at least there's no particle position. What we have is just a wave, and the wave, because it's a wave, it can go through two slits at the same time. Only at that final screen does the position of the particle appear when it's actually measured. So this is what standard quantum mechanics says. So our interpretation, of course, you can ask about particles and where they go, and what we say is that in any individual world, the particle will go through either the top slit or the bottom slit, and it will follow some path towards the final screen, and where it ends up is where you'll see it. So then, you know, how do you explain this interference phenomenon? Well, it's very simple, because a particle going through the lower slit can tell whether the upper slit is open or not, because in nearby parallel worlds, there are particles going through the upper slit, if it's open, whereas if it's closed, there won't be any. So what happens as you go past the slits and towards the screen is that the different parallel worlds will, they spread out and they can get close together. You get this repulsive force which prevents them from actually getting too close. And that sets up ripples, you know, which propagate through all of these sets of parallel worlds. And what we've shown by some detailed numerical simulations, which were done by Dirk Deckert, who's third co-author on the paper, is that we can get patterns that look essentially the same as the patterns predicted by quantum mechanics. So we did the simulations with 41 worlds, I believe. I mean, if you just glance at it, you'd say, oh, these two pictures look the same. If you look closely, you can see small differences. But what we think is that, you know, as you increase the number of worlds bigger and bigger, that those differences would get less and less.
So you're getting an interference pattern because each particle is interacting with other particles. It is interfering with other particles. It's just that they're in other worlds.
Yeah, so I try to avoid saying that it's interacting with other particles. But yeah, it's interacting, in a sense, with itself in parallel universes.
If we're thinking about the situation where one of the slits is covered, and, you know, we see this, you know, it's just like the particle just goes straight through that slit, like kind of a bullet through a hole.
Yep.
And, you know, we don't see any exciting interference pattern in that case. But if there are other classical worlds with the particle traveling almost the same path, you know, and I'm thinking of this idea of the repulsive force that you were talking about before. Shouldn't that show up as some kind of repulsive force between where, you know, the particle lands? Maybe it's slightly deviated from the path you might accept.
Yeah, no, actually, you're completely correct. And this is, of course, a part of standard quantum mechanics as well. So this is one of the misconceptions that sometimes gets about the double slit experiment, because no, it doesn't. You're absolutely wrong. What happens when it goes through one slit, so in standard quantum mechanics, you'd say that the wave spreads out. What we would say is that there's actually, in parallel worlds, you know, lots of the parallel worlds where the particles going through one slit, they repel each other. And so, yes, they don't follow straight line trajectories as they would if it was just like bullets. They do spread out. This is one of the calculations we showed, is that this phenomenon, that can be derived very easily from the repulsive force between parallel worlds which we postulate.
So let's talk about, you know, another thing that everybody thinks of when they think of quantum mechanics, and that is Heisenberg's uncertainty principle.
Okay, so maybe I should say what Heisenberg's uncertainty principle is. It says that you can't prepare a quantum particle so that you can know exactly what its position will be, if you measure that, and exactly what its momentum, which is essentially its velocity, is, if you were to measure that instead. Now, in our interpretation, in any one world, a particle does have a definite position and velocity. Because our worlds are essentially classical, so Heisenberg's uncertainty principle just does not apply to our world. But if we know with very great accuracy what the position of the particle is, that's essentially saying that we are narrowing down the possible places where all those parallel worlds can be. Okay, and if you do that, that's forcing them to be very close together. And a consequence of that is that the repulsive force between them is going to be very strong. Okay? And so essentially, as soon as you sort of let them go, they're going to repel each other. And that means that their momentum is going to be have a huge spread. So you might say that that's an intuitive way of understanding where Heisenberg's uncertainty principle comes from, too. I don't know whether it's been reasonable to you.
No, that does sound reasonable. I mean, it sounds like you've got this, you know, as I say, this wonderful checklist of things that you've explained. But I guess then the question is, what haven't you explained? You know, are there still things that you need to look into, other phenomena that you need to address?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a long list of things that we still need to do. Yeah, so basically to show how you get the so-called quantization feature of quantum mechanics, which is where quantum mechanics gets its name from the fact that, you know, atoms, for example, have these quantized energy levels. So where we think these quantized energy levels would come from is if you think of the total energy of the system in terms of the energy of each world and the interaction between the worlds, there are going to be multiple points of minimum potential energy, and those would correspond to like the ground state, the first excited state, the second excited state, etc. But that's just an idea, so we haven't actually shown that that quantitatively works. Some other things which we might address in a toy model, again, we have no reason to think this won't work, but you know, showing it explicitly would be really nice to show that we can get the quantum mechanical feature of non-locality, which comes from entanglement. So the intuitive explanation there would be that although each world in itself only has local interaction, so, you know, particles move around and bump into each other in ordinary three-dimensional case space and there's nothing non-local there, because of the form of the interaction between parallel worlds, which says that you get an interaction when the parallel worlds are close, but that means close in the sense that every single particle is close, that's actually a non-local type of interaction because it depends on the positions of all the particles at once, so to speak, no matter where they are in the universe.
The moment, you know, you've talked, or we've talked, and I've only asked you about explaining effects that we've already seen, but can you predict different effects that might occur because of this formulation? You know, how would we test it? What type of experiment could test this, you know, compared with standard quantum mechanics?
Yeah, so that's the $60 million question. In principle, our theory is not just quantum mechanics because, for instance, we think that it's only in the limit that the number of worlds becomes infinitely large that you actually get back quantum mechanics, okay? So we think that the theory is much easier to understand if you think of it being a finite but very large number of worlds. And then that raises the possibility that there could actually be deviations from our theory and from quantum mechanics. So this is sort of a hard thing to think about, but what it means is that, yeah, we might be able to come up with an experimental test which could tell whether it really is our theory which underlies quantum mechanics or whether it doesn't work.
Now, I apologize in advance for this next question because it's very fanciful, but it's popped into my head, and that means that I have to ask you. You know, we're sort of talking about the forces between these worlds, and I'm sort of thinking in a kind of very science fiction way, could you imagine manipulating that or using it in a way that would allow you to communicate with the other worlds or kind of send a message or somehow indicate to them that there is another world here?
Yeah, okay. So in our theory as it stands, we have no reason to think that that would be a feature of it, okay? Because obviously, actually signaling from one parallel world to another is something very different from standard quantum mechanics and would be a pretty startling thing. But if I take your question in the spirit of science fiction, as you said, then I think certainly in science fiction, you can imagine that that would be possible. I mean, if you start by saying, you know, let's imagine that this many interacting worlds approach is correct, then you have, you know, the whole reality is based on interacting parallel worlds, then, yeah, I think it's certainly possible, you know, in this sort of speculative science fiction context, to say, well, what if the interaction between the parallel worlds is not exactly as Hall, Deccan, and Wiseman are postulating? What if it's got some other contribution in it that does allow worlds that are further away to interact in some way and possibly to communicate? So personally, I think it would be great for science fiction writers to pick up on this. But as I said at the beginning, it's not part of our, you know, what we're trying to show or what we expect from our theory at all. But in terms of science fiction type speculation, sure. Yeah.
Thank you to Howard Wiseman for explaining his new theory to Zia. On the podcast page, www.fqxi.org/community/podcast, you'll find links to the team's paper, news coverage of their work, and links to previous podcast interviews about the different, but always entertaining, many worlds interpretation of quantum physics. That includes one of our most popular interviews ever with Nobel laureate and FQXI member Frank Wilczek, speculating on ways to test four parallel worlds.